Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy ad free. That's amazon.com/comedy ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Ask the Industry podcast, episode 128. I'm comedian Simon Kane, and for those of you new to the show, this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people from the worlds of stand-up, comedy, radio, and today, character comedy and social media. Andrew Doyle is a writer, comedian, and creator of Titania McGrath, a social justice woke warrior on Twitter, who satirically mocks social justice, who has exploded in popularity on so many different mediums, and recently just did a run at the Edinburgh Fringe. To find out how a Twitter account managed to do an entire Edinburgh run, you're going to have to listen to this podcast. He also co-wrote the satirical news reporter Jonathan Pye on YouTube, and has a history of making things go viral, as well as creating things bigger than himself. We talked about the power of social media, comedy wokeness, quotas, the future of building your audience online, and the best way to get your first 1,000 fans on Twitter. I think there's a ton of lessons in here, both good and bad. I think there's so many things that comedians who want to build an online profile and presence can take from this to help their social media grow effectively and avoid some pitfalls, maybe. Speaking of which, my book, How to Make a Living by Working for Free, is on sale, where I interviewed comedians, writers, and musicians about how they built their online community through free content and then asked them to support them through donations. It's £5 digitally, and there's a link in the description. It's perfect for anyone who wants to start building their online community. Before I hit play, remember that if you're new here, please do not forget to hit that subscribe button. If you're old here, please do consider to give us an honest, ideally positive review in iTunes. And either way, please do consider joining the Facebook group. It's called Ask the Industry Podcast, and it's on Facebook, obviously. But for now, this is Andrew Doyle.
This is a weird one, because there's two points I could start with, and maybe you want to tell me which one you prefer to start with. You're not a character at
stage. Well, my stand-up persona is a character, yeah.
Okay, because that was what I was a bit, because you are slightly different on stage to when I've spoken to you off stage.
Yeah, I am, yeah.
And so I didn't know whether you identify as a character or whether you...
It is a character, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, well, maybe let's start there then.
Okay. Well, it's a character based on me.
Okay. Explain the difference.
Because if I was just myself on stage, it wouldn't be very funny. So it is a characterization, a sort of perversion of who I actually am. So I sort of take some of my, usually my worst features and exaggerate them.
Okay.
Things like that. Or sometimes I just, the onstage me is much more bitter, much more downtrodden, much more self-pitying. So that's the main difference.
But because I always find it interesting, because most people who are characters are very much completely different from what they are.
Are they though? I mean, if you look at Stuart Lee's onstage persona, compared to who he actually is.
I haven't spent a lot of time off stage with Stuart Lee.
Okay, but it's obviously different, but it's not a million miles away. If you look at, I think pretty much anyone, actually, if you think about it, they have, when you perform stand-up, it's a performative thing, it's a theatrical thing, so you have to, you don't just behave in exactly, Scott Capurro would be another example, you know, I mean, like, if you... He has that sort of waspish quality off stage, but he certainly doesn't say the things that he would say on stage, and he certainly doesn't have that level of vitriol off stage. He's one of the most generous people I know. But you wouldn't know that if you watched him on stage, right? So there's all these sorts of... In fact, I can't think of a stand-up who is exactly the same off stage and on stage.
So how long have you thought of yourself as a character?
Since I've been doing stand-up.
So when you started, you thought, I'm writing this for the character of me. You didn't... Because I think when most people start, they just go, what's funny? They're just trying to grab for anything funny.
Oh, actually, when I started, the performance I did on stage was very far different from me, okay. more further than I am now. So I always saw it as a theatrical thing. I always saw it as essentially theatrical, you know, because, you know, I grew up watching Victoria Wood all the time, just constantly. And she was very different. She said a really interesting thing, actually, because I met her once and she was very prickly. And she said a really interesting thing on an interview. And I can't remember which one now, but she said, people see my stand up and they see me and they assume I'm this very warm, open person, and they can come up and they can talk to me and everything. But she said that along the lines of, but I'm just not very nice. And this is the interesting thing about her, you know, a complete genius, had cultivated this great onstage persona, but that wasn't like who she really was. That to me is really interesting. Also, I'm not a naturally funny person, so if I stand on stage and just be myself, it'll be pretty boring. I think I have to exaggerate, and I have to write the scripts very carefully, and I have to cultivate the character very carefully.
Okay, that's interesting. Because my first interaction with you, as in like before we met as comedians,
yeah,
was 2012, I think.
Was
when,
it?
When you, this was online, so it wasn't, you wouldn't know.
Did we have a row?
No.
Okay.
No.
That's normally how I meet people online.
Okay, fine. No. You had a row with someone else. You had a row with an audience member in Edinburgh, and you recorded it, and they threw a pint over you.
That's right, yeah.
And you uploaded that to the internet, and I don't know whether it was you who I saw it from, as in the share, or whether it was someone else, because I know it was floating around quite a lot. And I can't remember what the title of it was, but it was not clickbaity, but it was definitely something that would be more enticing than my 5 minutes at the comedy
store. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Right. And from that point on, I remember thinking, oh, okay, because it sort of turned my head a bit, because by that point, everyone I knew was just putting up 5 minutes, like I said, you know, right, 5 minutes, and then the brackets, the name of the club.
Yeah.
And so, and since then, I've seen you incorporate social media into pretty much everything you do.
And
sort of utilize it in a very interesting way for characters and for yourself.
So
if you maybe want to walk me through like your thought process in uploading that in that way, and maybe how that's informed your social media presence since then.
Well, that gives you a good example. That I was at the Caves that year.
Yeah.
Because no one knows who I am, so I wasn't selling particularly well. That happened after I think the first week or something, and things were slowing down ticket wise. So once that was posted, I sold out the rest of the run. So,
really?
Yeah. I mean, it got 100,000 views sort of over the next few days when it was uploaded. So, yeah. So, and it sold out completely. And I knew this would happen because when I would ask members of the audience, it was quite an interactive show. So I would ask members of the audience, you know, who saw the video, and most did. So it was definitely in terms of marketing, in terms of advertising, that straight away told me there was something quite successful about doing that. It wasn't as cynical as that, though. I didn't make the decision to upload it. It was the guy who was producing the show,
right?
And he also did a very clever thing of putting it through Reddit as well, and that got very high up in the Reddit charts of the most viewed posts. So but what that did teach me is that social media is a really effective tool to market yourself, really important tool actually, and it's the best way to put yourself out there, because you bypass the media, you bypass everything. You can get a broader reach than mainstream media through the internet. So and I have incorporated that ever since.
And that wasn't your choice. Do you dislike that they were putting it? I mean, they said to you, I'm going to put it up before I go put it up. Or is it a case of the next morning you're like, oh, we're sold out. How the hell did that happen?
No. They did ask me I was fine with it.
Yeah.
Because I also thought,
you came off well. Like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I thought it was funny, to be honest. So then I thought that's a reasonable reason to put it up. Mm. I particularly like that when the guy throws the beer, you can hear Scott Agnew shout at him. His very, very distinctive Glaswegian accent shouting at him. And he ran out after the guy threw it. And they had a sort of an argument outside. And it's all very dramatic.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
I didn't realise that sold out your run. That's really impressive.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you were in...
It was only a small venue, mind, you know, but it makes all the difference.
But the fact you didn't have to fly is a nice...
Yeah, perk. Exactly.
Because I noticed it, because you also run Comedy Unleashed, the comedy club, and that... I don't know whether you're following a model of other clubs or whether you've done it independently, but I know, for example, Hot Water are kind of the model for videoing acts and then putting them up online and doing that sort of thing.
I mean, it took a while. So Comedy Unleashed, it's taken about...
Do you want to explain what Comedy Unleashed is for anyone
else? Yeah. So the night is once a month in Bethnal Green at the Backyard Comedy Club, and the second Tuesday of the month. The purpose of the show is to say to the acts, look, we're not going to have just one type of political viewpoint represented here. You can say whatever you want. Don't self-censor, in other words. Don't worry about offending an audience. We don't believe that it's a safe space. We don't believe comedy should be a safe space. And it means, and I get emails a lot of the time from comics saying, you know, I've got some material I'd like to try out, but I can't really try it anywhere else. And that happens fairly regularly. So the message is getting across. Because even though it's only a very small minority of clubs who will send you a list of rules about what you can and can't say, that ethos is getting more and more common. And which I don't have a problem with. I think if you want to run a night where you say you only joke about this or whatever, that's totally up to you. I don't have an issue with that whatsoever. So we're saying, and also it's a response really to the climate we live in, because we live in the climate where most people, not comedians particularly, but people are nervous about what they say. They're nervous about joking with each other at work, in the workplace. They're nervous about being misinterpreted. They're nervous about tweeting and being misunderstood. So that everyone's playing it very cautious. And I understand that. I mean, I did it myself when I was a teacher. I knew full well that there were certain things I would tweet and I'd get fired for, which is a shame. And as comedians, we don't have that problem. As comedians, we can say whatever the hell we want, which is great. You know, I mean, we're so privileged in that sense. But I also know if I wasn't a comedian, I wouldn't be saying everything that I want to say. And that kind of climate of self-censorship is a real problem. And it is a problem for comedians as well, because comedians want to get on TV, they want to succeed, they want to do all that sort of stuff. And because the establishment, the comedy establishment, is so woke and is so sort of guarded about the sort of artistic exploration of sensitive issues, it means that comedians do self-censor. A lot of them do, not all of them, of course. A lot of the ones I speak to do, and they tell me about this. And of course, the ones who email me at Comedy Unleashed and say, "Can I have a spot?" So that's what we're doing. We're saying the audience. We often get recurring people. Sometimes we get new people, but the host will always explain what the night is. It means that you don't get a situation where people are going to misconstrue something you say on stage and get offended and storm out or try and stop the show and the kind of things that happen every now and then. Not often, but they do happen. The audience understands that. Part of the excitement of the stand-up comedy event is the possibility that anything could be said and that maybe your sensibilities might be knocked a bit. That's part of that's the great thing about the art form. It's one of the great things about the art form. So that's what we do. That's basically it. We encourage free-thinking acts to come and just push themselves a little bit. In practice, what that means is we just get good acts. You know, we just get good acts that play at other clubs and do similar sets at other clubs. And every now and then someone will come in and do something they don't normally do because they don't feel they can do it elsewhere. Yeah. Likewise, if there is a free speech issue in the media, we'll always defend it. So like when Vanity Von Glow was banned from various cabaret acts, I mean, seriously hurting her income for standing up for free speech. We obviously had to book her. Because if we don't, who the hell will, you know? Same with Count Dankula, the guy who did the Nazi pug video. Once someone has a criminal record for a joke, we have a kind of responsibility to have that person on our stage, I think, or at least to invite them. So we will do things like that as well.
So because within obviously everything comes down to context and intent, and within the room that context and intent can be made clear, and it's obviously perfectly understandable. But when you because you obviously record sets and put them out on the internet, and so I assume that when that happens, you maybe get more hate or maybe more backlash. Or there's,
I think the thing is that when people watch them, they realize just how funny the clips are. People are less likely to get annoyed or offended, and also the internet is kind of. I suppose we do get some. Yeah, I mean, particularly the Twitter account, which I don't run actually, but we get a lot of people going after the person who runs the Twitter account and having a big go and all the rest of it. But you know, that's the internet, isn't it? It's a free-for-all. And people will decide to get, I mean, the people who hate the club the most are the people who've never been. And they've sort of decided that it's something it's not, and they've got this sort of idea in their head that it's sort of a right-wing sort of fascist night or whatever, and where it's people just doing Burning Man material or stuff. And you know, that's their prejudice and that's their problem. For me, I never like to make any kind of judgment about a show or anything unless I have direct experience of it, because otherwise it's just guesswork, isn't it?
Yeah. I always find that, because I mean, I remember, you know, you've spoken about how you've been called a Nazi, for example, and you've been sort of called right wing in particular. I think I even spoke to you about how, because you wrote for Spiked for a bit, or I think you still do. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a columnist.
And that's caused people to think you're right wing.
Isn't that funny? I mean, that again displays the level of ignorance that must be associated with that. I mean, I always say this, but I do want to put this as a caveat, is that I don't think there's a problem with being right.
No, not at all.
And I have a real issue with the way people now use that as an insult.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't make any sense to me.
I understand the narrative in the media is left is good, right is bad.
Yeah, exactly.
But I don't actually think. I mean, I've got. Sounds really stupid. I've got friends who are right.
Yeah, yeah.
But
sure,
like, you know, we don't agree on everything. But yeah. the fun fact of life is you're not going to agree on everything.
Right.
And as long as they're not actively trying to hurt people, which fair enough, some people on both sides are. You know, people on my sides are throwing fucking milkshakes at people, exactly. And I don't agree with that.
So I'm not gonna play that game. I'm not gonna do this defensive thing saying, oh no, I'm not right wing. No, you know, no. Look at that. Like I'm just objectively not, and I'm not going to worry if occasionally some of my views would be classed as traditionally on the right. Fair enough, I don't care. If that happens, it happens. I'm not going to just say because otherwise it just comes down to tribalism. You say I'm on the left, and so therefore I must believe this, 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 and this, right? You've got a list of things that you must believe. Well, that means you're not thinking for yourself. That means you're just a robot, and I don't want to do that. I think very carefully about my opinions. I read very carefully, and I come to a conclusion, and I'm open to modify that conclusion subject to further discussion. That to me. Otherwise, I think it's just an intellectual death, to be honest. So that's where I am at politically. But what was your question again?
How you were.
Hello. Yeah. How are you? Now you're asking about being called a Nazi.
It's a combination. Basically, it's all wrapped around the difference between your online and offline personas.
You were asking about Spiked, actually.
I touched on that. Yeah.
And it is interesting, isn't it, that the main criticisms from Spiked either come from people who have never read it and don't know what it is, or these odd conspiracy theorists that go back to like 20 years who, when Spiked used to be Living Marxism magazine, and there was a big court case relating to the war in Bosnia. And there are many disputes about the details of that situation. But the point is there are lots of grudges being held by people like Nick Cohen at The Guardian, people like George Monbiot. So they're stuck in the past and they're conspiracy theorists and they believe in this sort of Living Marxism network of people, this revolutionary communist party network who infiltrate the TV and infiltrate radio and media and all this sort of stuff. And it's real tinfoil hat stuff. And so if you write for Spiked, they go after you. Nick Cohen's gone after me a number of times. He's very angry at me for writing for Spiked. And it's his problem. It's his personal grudge that he's got with old communists, I guess.
So when you take jobs... Yeah. So like when you, because I mean, I was going to ask you about this as a general thing for Titania and that sort of area anyway. But when you get approached, but I assume you didn't approach Spike, they approached you.
Yes, they did. Tom Slater, who's the deputy editor, approached me to write a column for them. In fact, the first time he asked me to write for them, I did. I wrote an article or two, but I didn't want to make it a regular thing. Yeah. And I think that was largely out of cowardice because of the stigma attached to the publication, but not. The stigma isn't there, for instance, if you go to America. The stigma is only there amongst a certain type of identitarian leftist in this country.
It's the same with... I've had debates. I've seen people on this fringe do jokes about The Guardian, and I've asked them, how often do you read it? And they go, oh, just when there's like one column piece by a person.
I read it every day. I read it every day. I still hate The Guardian, but I read it every day. Well, I have a good knowledge of The Guardian. Yeah, I know it backwards. It is the equivalent of the... It's the Daily Express for the left. It is a tabloid... propagandist, bourgeois, Blairite rag, basically, and it isn't honest in the stories it selects, and its opinion columns verge on the cultish, to be honest. So, I say this out of experience. I know this publication,
but I think that's. I mean, while we're talking about cultish things, then I mean, how repeat is your audience for Comedy Unleashed? Could you expand the night, and could you?
Yeah, I think it's. You know, it took a while to grow a base that come back repeatedly, but they won't come every month. And then every time Rhea, Lena, or whoever is hosting that particular night, she hosts quite a lot, she'll say, you know, who's been before. And it's always actually about half and half, which is quite nice because it means we are always getting new people in, but we've also got a kind of base that come back every now and then to the night. So, yeah, so that's quite good in a way. But yeah, it's certainly something we could expand with talking about it.
No, but I wondered whether, because a lot of nights, little independent nights especially, that are only run monthly, for example, have an audience that pretty much, not every month, but they've got a core base that will come every month, and then there's sort of a rotating cast of people.
Yeah.
And so, for example, you can't book people, you can maybe MCs on a regular basis, but you can't book acts on a regular basis because...
No, we can't. We MCs are different. So like Dominic Frisby or Rhea Lena or people who we have back to MC. That's okay. We don't want people Jeff Norcott's done it a number of times, but there's always like a good 4 months between each appearance. Scott Capurro, likewise. Jojo Sutherland's done it a couple of times. So people have come. Yeah, we, you know, Issa Bonacera, we've had a number of times because we think she's brilliant. We have. But
who's we? Who are you,
me and Andy Shaw, who run the night.
Okay.
So we have. Exactly. We don't. We try to have different acts. We try to, you know, mix it up a bit, and we want the audience to have a different experience every time they go. We want every night to be unique.
Yeah, I presume there's not like a normal club, a progression ladder. It's just you like them, you book them, you pay them. That's it.
Sort of. I mean, we do a lot of research into the acts at first, and also it's about. It's about whether I want them and Andy want. It's about whether we agree,
right?
Basically, so that's the way we do it, and yeah, and we've started getting people back, but only after a few months. Like that's the point. We don't have them immediately after each other. The only exception is the Christmas show last year, where we had everyone was doing just 5 minutes. It was just a fun night, and we were packing as many nights. Acts in at once, but even that's a different kind of show, isn't it?
Yeah, and do you find the same as you did with that viral video of your own, that the videos encourage people to come back, or is it?
Yeah, I think so. I think they. I think that. I mean, I don't know, to be honest, how much that has helped the marketing. I mean, Andy's the one who's really on top of all of that sort of stuff, so he will probably have some data on that, because he's quite rigid on that. He'll check stuff out. I don't know, maybe. They seem to get a good share, so they seem to get reach quite an audience, you know.
I find it really interesting when I talk to clubs generally about social media, because a lot of them have a similar response to you, even the ones that are on top of it. They go, we don't know if it's making a difference, but we know that we feel like we're out there.
Well, the good thing about it is it's good for the acts, right? It means they've got a video online, they can then post to people and say, you know, this is something I do.
But do any of them, like you with Spiked, not want to send it because of the reputation of the club to people that haven't played it? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, a few.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that annoying?
Well, it's up to them. It's I understand it. I mean, but that's sort of, this is what I was going back to, what I talked about this climate where people are afraid to put their head above the parapet. This is the climate we live in now, and I often get messages from people saying, I really like what you do, but I'm not going to retweet it, or I'm not going to be public about that. And you know, that is a shame, but I also understand it, you know, I get it.
Yeah.
I hope that the culture will change, that people will stop behaving in such an infantile way and just assuming that anyone who disagrees with them is evil. Hopefully we'll get to that point at some point. I mean, where we are at the moment is that it's not just the politically naive who say that, it's actually some of the smartest people have bought into this really tribalistic worldview, and it's very sad. It's anti-enlightenment, and it does represent the infantilism of our culture. It's a shame. It's a shame. So hopefully we'll move beyond that.
Okay. So while we're talking about raising our heads above the parapet and sort of putting your neck out, briefly, let's talk about Titania.
Okay.
We'll sort of talk about her now and then talk about the show a little bit later.
Yeah.
So Titania is ostensibly a Twitter character, but it's become more than that.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't mean to downplay it. I just mean where it started.
Yeah, yeah, sure. And it's not downplaying it. That's exactly where it started.
No,
yeah.
I know, but I...
Yeah,
I'm overly paranoid about insulting your work. That's why I just
don't worry. You can slag it off if you like.
Okay, no, I like it. I follow it.
It's okay, good.
Yeah, yeah. I find it really interesting that especially when people found out you write it.
Yeah.
As a man.
Yeah.
There was an issue with that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I always find, I mean, I've heard you talk about how it's a character and you can write characters for any gender or race or creed or whatever because thing. But I wonder whether if you said the same thing on your Twitter feed, would you get more backlash? And is that why you've created this, so that you can say things that you have written in your head for you, but you think, oh God, there's a climate here that won't allow a man to say it?
It wouldn't work for me though, because the character is so different from who I am.
Right.
It wouldn't make sense for me to start going on about how we need to ban everything, and you know, it has to come through a character, that kind of thing.
Right.
It only works. Those sort of sentiments only work if you are an authentic sort of intersectional fourth wave feminist activist, or it's a character taking the piss out of those people. That's the only way it works. So it just simply isn't something I could do through my own voice.
When you made that Twitter account and it had no followers,
yeah,
how did you build that from nothing?
Oh, good question. No one's asked me that. I started in April last year. And the point for me was just, I was just entertaining myself, really, but I wanted to sort of poke fun at the social justice movement, and largely out of frustration.
Why? Why?
Because I've always been committed to things like genuine social justice, anti-racism, anti-homophobia, equality of the sexes, all the rest of it. And we've now got a movement that makes all those causes look stupid, and that's a problem. So, and we've got a movement that is determined to divide us all up, to undo the great work of the civil rights movements of the 60s and 70s, to rehabilitate racism, to make us a more racist society, inadvertently, I should say. All of that stuff is incredibly damaging, and I think it's the best way to deal with it is to take the piss out of it, because it is funny, because it's a bourgeois movement, because it is so dominated, of course not exclusive, but it's so dominated by people who are sort of privately educated and have this sort of middle class background, and yet believe they are these sort of oppressed underdogs. It's very difficult to penetrate. It's a very kind of, they're very powerful people. There's not many of them, but they're so disproportionately powerful. So it is a hard thing to, and they're funny, you know. Some posh person who is privately, went to bloody, I don't know, Brighton College or something, really posh, who writes for The Guardian, who then turns around and says, I'm so oppressed, and then writes a book about what an oppressed person she is. And then, you know, there was another book about similar Guardian columnist, independently wealthy millionaire, grew up in Wimbledon, writes about how she wished she'd grown up in a council estate, that would have been better. And, you know, all this kind of stuff, it's funny. Ultimately, it's funny when people who are so privileged are determined to tell other people that they're the oppressors and they're the... It's so daft.
Yeah. No, that reminded me, I just saw Jeff Norcock's Middle Class Ruined Britain or something like that.
Yeah, the documentary.
Yeah, it was really well done. Yeah. Really well put together. I'd never really...
It got a lot of flack for it.
Did it?
Yeah.
I really want to talk to him about it because I have never come into contact with him really before that. And I remember there was one bit where he was in the council estate there where he grew up.
Yeah.
And he says, I tell all my friends it was better back then when I grew up here. But everything I do is trying to make sure my kids don't grow up here.
Yeah.
And so when you say someone really independently wealthy who goes, oh, it'd be lovely to be in a council estate, you sort of think, maybe watch just that 30 seconds.
Well, she's fetishizing it, isn't she? And she,
that's, you know, the problem, yeah,
know,
yeah.
And it's, you know, I mean, I suppose I shouldn't name names, but, you know, she's a person who has had utter privilege. But because she's a person of colour, she believes that instantly makes her an oppressed victim. And it's very funny when someone has all of this money. This is not to say she hasn't faced racism.
Oh, no, not at all.
The point is that to deny the sheer advantages, the way in which the odds are stacked in your favour if you come from that sort of background, with that, I mean, really, this is the main problem with identity politics in its current form, is it is pretty blind when it comes to class issues, and in fact it's sort of actively hostile to them. And the reason for that being, of course, that most of the people who perpetuate it are very, very privileged financially, so it's in their interest not to sort of skirt over that main issue. But ultimately, you know, I've taught in private schools, in posh schools. You know, if you're a black lesbian who goes to one of the poshest girls' schools in the world, you're still pretty fine, right? You're still, you know, this isn't to say you won't face misogyny and everything, but you're not in the same position as were you to go to some rough state school. You know, it's just not the same thing, right? These girls used to come into school and talk about how they've just got an internship at GQ because daddy's sort of put a word in and all this. They have no idea, right? So they don't know what it's like to not be able to afford to get the bus, basically. So that will never happen to them. So this sort of misapplication of privilege is something I was interested in satirizing. I think it's just funny.
So how did you get your first 1,000 followers?
Yeah, that was the question you actually asked, wasn't it? Don't know. I decided early on she was a slam poet. I put out the poems, always used to do very well. You know what it is? It's when you get amplified by people with many followers. That's the way to do it. And I would often reply to people who were quite well known, or I would quote tweet people who were quite well known. Now, if they got in on the joke, they would sometimes retweet it. And that really amplifies you. At the time, the Godfrey Elphick account was still up and running. And that was the genderqueer Muslim atheist character on Twitter who's been completely banned and will never go back, but a sort of legendary Twitter persona who was a very sharp satirical thing, run by two people. One of them is now a friend of mine, Lisa Graves. And at the time, Godfrey was still active and he retweeted Titania a lot and used to say things like about when he met Titania at a slammer poetry event and all this sort of stuff. And of course, he had many followers, almost 100,000 followers. So that boosted it as well. And then what really boosted it was about, I think about 3 months in, 4 months. No, a bit later. It was September, I think. She'd been banned about, I'd had a number of 1 day suspensions, about 3 or 4 one day suspensions and 2 7-day suspensions for quote unquote hate speech. And then I got the permanent ban from Twitter, which meant that I got, whenever anyone went to the account, it came up as account suspended. Now, by that point, I had enough high profile followers, particularly in America.
On your account or her account?
On her account.
Okay.
And they started tweeting about it. And you had some quite sort of big presences on Twitter saying effectively, look, this is proof that Twitter is an ideological, a partisan entity. It doesn't want to be mocked because Twitter's so woke. Like the people who work in those sort of San Francisco tech giant company, they're so super woke. This was a character that was taking the piss out of their worldview, and they took this opportunity to ban her. Mm. So then you have lots of commentators pointing this out and saying, look, this is evidence that Twitter is partisan. So within 24 hours, the account was restored. And I can't help but think it's that Twitter realized that it was being used as ammunition against them. That's the only reason I can think that happened, because it's unprecedented. I don't know of any case where they've undone a permanent ban, you know, because appeals mean nothing to Twitter. It never works. So
do you think
then she got 20,000 followers the next day,
right,
off the back of the ban, because of the Streisand effect, as you know, whenever you try and censor something, this is why one of the reasons I'm totally anti-censorship. It draws attention to bad ideas.
Mm.
Basically, it gives them currency and it allows them to breed. So. So that's what happens.
So do you, and I mean this in a nice way, do you now think you're bulletproof on Twitter with that account?
No.
Because surely they can never take it down, because then they'll just say again, look, they're censoring them again. So surely creative license is made, no?
I'm bulletproof insofar as I don't care if they ban me.
Okay.
Like, at this point, I've written the book, I've done the show, there's other avenues I'm exploring.
Is that what you wanted from it, a book originally, or was it just for fun?
No, that wasn't even my idea. That came out from my agent contacted me, because the publisher he often works with was interested in something about wokeness,
right?
And so my agent said to me, you know, do you think you might be able to do something about wokeness? And I said, well, I've got this character, coincidentally, I've only been doing it a couple of months, and she's this woke slam poet, and my agent had been following her without knowing it was me, because I hadn't told anyone. I mean, I literally hadn't told anyone. And so, and then I got the book deal out of that. And then when she was permanently banned, what happened, because of all the publicity, because then it became a news story, we just moved the publication date forwards a few months, and I pretended as the character that I'd written it in my 24 hours off Twitter, which of course is just a joke. But
so, all of it's just a joke.
Yeah, of course. The book was ready to go anyway. But yeah, so if they ban me now, you know, that's all right.
Your book sales will go through the roof.
It will help, but also it'll be a bit of a relief. Then I can just concentrate on other things, right? It's not, it doesn't bother me if that happens. But they probably, and I think they will at some point, you know, it's so arbitrary, this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the character's essentially become a tulpa, because now it's a show, it's a real person
who
plays, you know, the character.
Yeah.
And I suppose the interesting part for me for that is, you know, it's such an online thing and such an ethereal thing.
Yeah.
How hard is it to transfer this 100 or 280 character thing to a book, which I suppose is just like a longer dry tribe of tweets, or maybe
it's separated into 20 odd chapters, each one dealing with a different theme,
right,
and interspersed with examples of her slam poetry. So it has a very clear, definite structure. You have to think structurally when you do these sort of things, you know. It's not like a tweet. A tweet is effectively has the impact of a one-liner, doesn't it? Although with her, it's not just about the one-liner. Sometimes it's about trying to bait people into responding and taking it seriously. That's the other thing that it does. And likewise with the live show, it has to have an arc. It has to have a structure to it and all of that. So it's a different kind of thing. It is difficult. And also, we did a big casting process. And Alice Marshall, who plays her, is utterly brilliant. And she brings her own interpretation to the character as well. So all of that is really interesting to me.
Mm. No, I You mentioned your agent.
Mm.
How did you find your agent?
How did I find my agent? Well, this is a literary agent. I've got two agents. I've got a comedy agent and a literary agent.
Well, we can talk about both, because you're a writer and a comedian.
Yeah. It was through my Spiked articles. He read a lot of my articles and really liked them and wanted, and approached me and said, you know.
So it's a right-wing agent. No, I'm joking.
No, it's not.
I know.
That's the weirdest thing, isn't it, with Spike? I mean, Spike is a Marxist, left-wing
humanist. I was only joking.
I love it. I love that people... Because it's anti-Trump, it's anti-Tory. I can't think where people are coming from. Anyway, look, don't know what they're talking about. Yeah, he approached me. He was saying that I might be interested in writing a full-length book about politics, mm-hmm. and it's certainly about identity politics, which I'm probably going to do next. I think that's my next thing, because I feel like with Titania, that's the satirical approach, and I want to take the polemical approach, which is what I do either on TV or in the articles that I write. So I want to write something serious about this stuff, because I think it's a really serious issue. Mm. I think the rise of the woke movement is divisive. It is feeding the far right, which is a particular concern of mine, and so we've got to do something about it. And not suggesting that I'm going to be able to do it, but I feel like at least I could contribute to the discussion. Mm. But yeah, that's how I got here. He contacted me. I find that with agents largely, isn't it, that they like to feel they're doing the chasing. I'm not saying that of my agent, by the way. That sounds a bit mean, but I think my experience in the past with agents is, if you chase, particularly comedy agents, I think if you're chasing them all the time, that puts them off.
How did that, so just emailed you and then you met for a drink? Like, what's the process of getting a literary agent for your perspective? Was this your first literary agent, or is it?
No.
Okay.
I've had a few.
Okay.
I think that was, in this case, yeah, he DM'd me on Twitter. That was all that was. Right. And then we met for a drink and that was that.
Only just signed off the top of that?
Yeah, as simple as that.
And what made you, and you maybe don't want to name who they are, but what made you leave the previous agents? What were the red flags for you, or what made that not work?
The first agent I had just wasn't very proactive. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the case with most agents, actually. I'm very lucky at the moment. I've got two very good agents who are proactive. But my experience in the past has been people who, they will basically sit back and wait for you to get the work. And they'll wait for you to get the opportunities. And they will focus on their acts who already have a large reach, and they're making more money off them, obviously. But of course, that's counterproductive, what they should be doing. Good agents will invest in new talent who aren't going to make the money in the short term, but will make the money in the long term if they're far-sighted. Mm. That's the way it should be. You know, and they can be really great, or they can be useless. And it's always, I don't know how useful it is for people to be with an agent who is doing nothing for them.
What did your agent say they saw in you? Like, what plan do they have for you? Or did they come to you and say, I want to work with you, what do you want to make? Like, what was the... Who works for who, in other words?
I think he was interested in the way in which I write in an argumentative way. I think he was interested in that I've got a lot of experience in rhetoric. And it was the idea that I was expressing ideas that he had felt in a way that he considered to be an elegant style, and that it would suit a full-length prose piece. Mm. I think that was his feeling about it. Mm. You know, there's also the awareness that the publishing industry, for instance, is very, very woke, and that the fact that we got the Titania book published is by a mainstream publisher is pretty astonishing. Mm. But that's why you need an agent who is on board with what you're saying and understands and gets what you're doing. So yeah, that's also the agent had done some previous political books,
right,
and had worked with people like Douglas Murray and people who had, you know, and so had some sort of background in this kind of writing. And it just so happens that the first book I ended up doing with him was a comedy book, which wasn't actually the original plan. That sort of put everything on hold. So now I'm sort of going to go back to that. I'm going out I'm going away for 2 weeks straight after the Fringe. And I'm going to isolate myself, as I always do when I go to write. I just completely isolate. I go to an island called Sark, which is very... There's no cars allowed on Sark. It's in the Channel Islands.
Okay.
But you can't... There's no cars allowed there, so it's very quiet. It's just an occasional horse, you know. Right. And there's no... There's 500 people live there. There's no one around. You can cycle to the other end of the island in half an hour. It's really peaceful, but also weirdly inspiring. It's not beautiful in the conventional sense. It's beautiful in a kind of scary gothic sense. You know, very steep drops everywhere. It's the highest of the Channel Islands. It doesn't have those sort of bays, you know, gradual slopes down. It's these sheer drops absolutely everywhere. It's got these twisted, gnarled trees that look like fingers because the winds are so strong. And it's a very interesting place just to go. And I sit at the top of a cliff every day with a laptop and write, and that's what I've been doing. That's how I wrote the Titania book.
Right.
I went there to do that. I just need that sort of peace. But I'll go out there and I will just write politics. And that's all I will do. And I'm not gonna think about comedy. I'm not going to crack a smile the whole time. That's my view.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how about your comedy agent? How did you meet them?
My current comedy agent, and I have had different ones in the past. My current comedy agent, I got while I was working. Well, I wrote with Jonathan Pye for 3 years for the character of Jonathan Pye.
So you don't write to him anymore?
No, no, no.
Okay.
And I think what had happened is Tom's agent, Tom who plays the character, wanted me to come on board as well because it makes sense and and things are much easier that way. And now I'm with that agent, although Tom's no longer with that agent. So that was more to do with work I was already doing, to be honest.
Mm. Okay. And what about your previous agents then? How did they go? Why didn't they work out? Is it a similar reason?
Yeah, really nice people just weren't doing much for me.
Okay.
Basically.
Yeah. No, it's always interesting to hear the perspective of the performer and find out what maybe your red flags were, because most people, as you know, maybe when you first start out, the big thing is I just need to get an agent because they open doors, they'll get you on TV.
I think people worry too much.
It is overrated.
The key thing that people should do is just do their work and express themselves and create the work they want to create. And if there's a market for it, the market will open up.
Mm.
Rather than trying to anticipate what the market is and trying to anticipate what agents want. Mm. I find that's very, it rarely works.
Yeah.
Because you can't anticipate the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
I've always been, in terms of the work I produce and stuff, it's always been just whatever I've wanted to do with a consciousness that the stuff I'm doing isn't very fashionable. Like, I've never really hit the fashionable zeitgeist at the right time. I've never done that. I think Titania is the only exception, probably, you know, where there's been a hunger for this kind of thing.
Mm.
But I didn't do it cynically because I sensed there was that. I just did it, and it just happened.
See, that's interesting, is because I think, especially because we're at the Edinburgh Festival at the moment.
Yeah.
And here, I've dropped into compilation shows, and I've seen a few things, and you do get the vibe that some people are doing what they think will sell on TV TV. And personally, I just don't see the point in that.
No, it's stupid. And I was a reporter for The Independent asked me this in an interview. She said, you know, is it a bit cynical that you're marketing this show as being sort of anti-woke at a time where that seems to be getting a lot of press? And I'm thinking, well, how else would I market it? That's exactly what the show is. And why do you think it's getting a lot of press? There's only like 3 or 4 of us doing this kind of stuff on the fringe. There's 3,000 shows or whatever. It's not like this is some big thing.
Mm.
And you know, Titania is part of that, part of the reason it's in the press, right? So it's a really weird question to ask, actually.
Time for a break, but fuck me if we covered a lot in this interview. He takes on quotas, comedy policing, the future of the industry, which all have really interesting perspectives, and his writing process, which we get into more later on in the podcast. I really enjoyed hearing everything that goes in behind the scenes to create just a single tweet and an audience, and how he capitalizes on their attention to sell tickets and merch and books and everything. I'm really loving putting this one together. As always, here comes your mid-roll ad. If you want to kill the ads and get rid of them, you can go ad-free from $1 on Patreon. That's 80p. That's nothing. You must be able to afford that. That's so cheap. You can sign up in the time it takes to listen to this advert. It's literally 90 seconds. And if you can only do it for a few months, that's perfectly fine as well. Anyone and everyone for any amount of time at any amount of money really helps this show continue. So please check out patreon.com/AskTheIndustryPodcast. The link's in the show notes. Here's your advert, you freeloader. And we're back.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You have a notepad ready because the amount of social media advice in the next section is massive. Let's dive back in.
Anyway.
No, that's I get what you're saying. It comes down to I suppose it's weird because they'll ask that question, yeah. But then they will avoid asking questions about quotas, which is essentially the same thing. What they've said you're a small group of people doing a thing, so you're fitting into a niche.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's getting elevated. Is that a good thing? And it's sort of like with a quota, surely that's similarly to what's happening. They're going, okay, we'll have this group of people and we'll elevate them because they're this small and we haven't been helping them out before. And I wondered where you stand on quotas and where you stand on sort of trying to elevate voices. And
a quota system is an admission of prejudice. So it's important when there are historical situations. For instance, an example I've given before, but it's a good one, I think, is like the PSNI, the Police Service of Northern Ireland, formerly the RUC, Royal Ulster Constabulary, who had a history of being a overwhelmingly Protestant force that would terrorise Catholic individuals, particularly in the 60s and 70s in Derry and Belfast. So you've got a situation where, in order, particularly with the febrile political climate in Northern Ireland, you have to institute some kind of quota system. You have a kind of institutionalized prejudice against Catholics, which is demonstrable on the basis of historical evidence. So you have to bring in quotas or something to ensure that we get some more Catholic police. So they had to do that. And that was the right thing to do. So in that sort of situation, I would support it. When a TV, a broadcaster, starts like when the BBC advertised internships for non-whites only, what they are saying there is that they believe that their employers are racist, which is an odd admission to make, especially because I don't think it's true. It's just simply not the case. So no, I'm against those sort of quota system. I think it's patronizing to minorities. I think if you are secure that you are not a racist organization, then you don't, or not a homophobic organization or whatever, then you don't need those things. The reason they do it is because they believe in these invisible power structures in society and this idea of unconscious bias, which is a complete bunkum as far as I mean we all have a million unconscious biases. I'm not interested in how people the biases of the people, I'm interested in the way people behave. That's what matters. And so these sort of quasi-religious viewpoints, which have been totally taken from the woke culture, have infected things like the major broadcasters and the arts generally. They're not true. There is no evidence for them, but they nevertheless are taken as... I mean, let's give a good example from this week. The Advertising Standards Authority banned two adverts, one for cheese, one for a Volkswagen Golf vehicle, on the basis that, for instance, the Volkswagen advert depicted a woman next to a pram. And they banned it, saying that this was perpetuating harmful negative stereotypes, presumably the stereotype that some women have prams and have babies, which is true.
And they look after them.
And they look after them, right? So it's not... And they banned the cheese advert because it depicted the idea that men weren't good parents or something. Anyway, look. And the only reason that makes sense is if you believe that putting these messages out there has this trickle-down effect in society and warps everyone's minds. It's this very paternalistic, patronizing idea of normal people. That's really, and that comes from the woke movement. The woke movement don't believe that normal people, let's just say honestly, working class people, can be trusted to know the difference between a joke and real life, to know the difference between an advert and real life, and that they're just these sort of malleable creatures that just do whatever they're programmed to do. It's a really pessimistic view of humanity, and I don't subscribe to it. But look, there you have it, the ASA, Advertising Standards Authority, a quango, which has an awful lot of power because it's been given that power by the government, can arbitrarily decide that this faith-based position on the basis of media representation is going to be implemented, and it's going to affect us all now, and they're going to ban adverts. It's a joke, and it shouldn't happen. And actually what the government need to do is scrap these quangos because they are so overwhelmingly woke.
And is that your similar opinion in comedy?
In what sense?
As in quotas in comedy.
I don't think they're necessary. I think they would be necessary if, for instance, you could point to a specific promoter who has an obvious record of only hiring men, for instance. Then in that sort of case, I would support some sort of quota system. You know, that isn't happening very much as far as I can see, you know, particularly with the, well, particularly not on, on television. It's certainly not happening. Broadly speaking, I don't support it, but actually even come to that thinking about it, if someone wants to run a night where it's only men, that's up to them as far as I can see. Likewise, we have nights for any women and what, you know, I just wouldn't go to that sort of night. It doesn't interest me. If I book people on the basis of whether they're good or not. That's it. And whether they're free thinking comics and whether they're interesting comics and whether they're willing to take risks. And as a result, if you look at the Comedy Unleashed back catalogue, we have just about the most diverse range of people you'll get. Because if you focus on meritocracy, you end up having parity anyway. That's the point.
Yeah, no, I find all these quotes really interesting, and I sort of move around whether I feel good or bad about them.
Well, look, if someone booked me and said, I want you on this panel show because you're gay and we need a gay person, I would almost certainly say no.
That was going to be my next question. Right. I was going to ask, A, have you ever benefited from a quota? And B, have you ever felt like you have been booked because of one?
No, I think I've not been booked because of it, because insofar as there used to be this feeling that we've got one gay act on, we don't want a second gay act on. I think a lot of female comics who I've spoken to feel the same way. Historically, there have been certain promoters who will be like, well, we'll have just one woman. This stuff isn't good. I don't support anything like that. But I also don't support imposing quotas to make sure it doesn't happen. I think the best way to do it is to just... you know, try and promote the idea that we should all just book on the basis of merit. And then what will happen is naturally these things will resolve themselves, because most promoters aren't these sort of bigots, are they? They're not really. You've got a few old has-beens who have that quality. Well, that's fine. It's no big deal if we just avoid them, is it? Mm. You know, it's no big deal if you don't get booked by them. Like, get booked by the people who... Why would you want to work for someone like that? I don't think I would. Have I ever benefited from a quota? I've been booked for gay gigs, exclusively gay gigs, which tend to be awful. The only exception is Zoe Lyons' Bent Double Night, which is brilliant, but that's because it's not just, you know, you get loads of straight people in there as well, you get gay people in there. It's just a kind of, it's got a sort of gay ethos. It has a historical kind of gay ethos in Brighton, which strikes me as a reasonable thing to do. It certainly isn't exclusionary to straight acts or to straight audience members, you know, so that sort of thing's kind of fun. But no, I did a terrible LGBT night in at the Leicester Comedy Festival with it was the kind, because I think the problem as well is a lot of the LGBT community, if such a thing exists, have a kind of have bought into this woke bullshit, and as a result are their ears are pricked for any kind of indication that they should be offended by something, you know, that and so you get that very kind of Mary Whitehouse style. It's like performing to a bunch of Mary Whitehouses sometimes. So on the whole, I just prefer to my view of all this stuff is I would not like to benefit from these kind of quotas, and if I suspected that I was, I would probably do something about it.
Do you want to be famous?
No.
Because I find it interesting that your characters and the characters you've worked on, like Jonathan Pye and like Titania,
yeah,
are, on the face of it at least, more well-known than you.
Yeah, 100% they are, yeah. Much better that way.
Is that a conscious move on your part?
I have no interest in fame, and not only that, I don't understand people who do. I don't get it.
Right.
I don't know why you would want that. The idea that you should be validated by the more people who would recognise you strikes me as very shallow and must be the result of some kind of insecurity. I mean, I know we all have a sizable ego, otherwise we wouldn't be doing what we do. Of course, I mean, I'm not, you know, obviously I'm not going to deny that if someone comes up to me and says, oh, I like what you do and everything, I will enjoy the compliment. You know, I'm a human being ultimately, and I do have an ego. I think it's always good to keep that ego in check. But I'm not interested in fame for its own sake. No, not at all. All I want really is to have the freedom to be creative, my creative freedom. I want the freedom to make the works that I want to make, to write the things I want to write, and to be financially stable enough to do that. And of course, the fame element, like, the more people know about you, the easier that becomes, of course. So that's that's why I'm not going to turn down when, you know, if I'm invited to go on television and things like that. I do it partly because I want to, express my views on things. That's partly what I, you know, that it's very satisfying. I really enjoy that. But also I'm aware that it will enable me to sell more tickets, and ultimately I don't come from a wealthy background, so I have to be aware of that, and I need to cultivate a following in order to be able to make the work that I want to make. That's my only priority there.
Okay, so you've done like TV shows where you are able to go on and be you. I assume you're not playing your character then.
No, I do Sky News every 2 weeks and stuff, and I go on various things to talk about issues. No, that's me. That's me 100%.
I'm just distinguishing between the two.
Yeah, sure, but I'm not trying to be funny there. That's the other thing is
that's what I was going to say.
They often introduce me as writer and comedian, and then you think, oh, but why aren't you making any jokes? Because I'm being myself.
That's what I was going to ask, because there's a lot of cases of people who do, let's say, a sitcom character, or they go on a panel show or something, and people come expecting something else at a show.
Yeah, sure.
And I'm wondering whether you found people coming from watching you on Sky for some reason and are expecting almost in a way no jokes, just some sort of dry, you know, political rant or something. Has that ever happened? Is that happening to you?
I remember Paul Sinner mentioning to me about, like, a lot of the fans who come to his show now are Chase fans.
Okay.
So you kind of get, so there's a slightly different expectation.
I saw Nish Kumar the other day.
Oh, yeah.
And 5 minutes in, he just went, I know, I look nicer on the MASH report.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was weird, because I've never seen the MASH report. I've seen clips of it online, but it was a weird one to hear him sort of go, oh, okay, I know that they edit me and I'm calmer or whatever.
Yeah, but at least with Nish, it's like the MASH report is a comedy show, so at least the audience who like that will have some sort of similar expectation, you know. But I think with someone like me, it's not going to affect me so much, because I'm not famous in the way that Nish and Paul are famous. So I don't think anyone comes to my shows on the basis of me doing the paper review on Sky News. I would be really surprised if they did.
Well, no, because we were talking at the start about people coming from social media, and so I'm wondering whether comparatively, if you still ask, I don't know if you still ask your audience, whether they come still from social media or whether they are coming from TV, and how those two compare.
I don't ask, actually, but I do get the sense that a lot of the audience, for instance, my show this year, I get the sense a lot of the audience are coming from because of Titania. Right. That's probably true. Or I have some people who are aware that I wrote half of Jonathan Pye for 3 years, so there's that, but there's not many who were really that aware of that. So I don't know. I think largely in Edinburgh as well, it's people coming back because they've seen you in previous years. I mean, this is the 7th solo stand-up show I've done, so there are people who know my work here who wouldn't know me anywhere else. You know, it's a bit of a bubble here, isn't it? So it's a combination of all those things, I imagine.
Mm. Yeah, no, it's. I've spoken to a few comedians this festival, especially for this podcast, and a lot of them got medium to large-sized social media followings.
Yeah.
Who say, you know, I'll do a panel show and ask, you know, has anyone seen me on it? And no one will come.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? Like, even if you do, like, a Mock the Week kind of thing, it doesn't necessarily translate into ticket sales, does it?
No, but then when I've spoken to two agents at this festival for the pod, and one for my own stuff, and they were like, well, if you did the show, you'd have to burn that material. And I'm a bit like, but it doesn't sound like the people that are watching me there or would watch me there would come and see me live.
Maybe
so it's
not.
Odd that they think burn it when it doesn't feel like... Well, but having said that, I suppose Lou Sanders, she did a thing at the start of her show where she said, anyone seen me before? And it was crickets. And then they said, anyone seen me from the Taskmaster? And everyone went, yeah! So I suppose it depends on what you're doing on TV.
Yeah, it does. It does. I don't think anything I do on TV... Because what I do on TV is not comedic. So I don't think anything I do on TV translates into stand-up comedy ticket sales. And I'm not well-known enough for that to make a difference.
Are you doing this many different things because you want to have different forms of income and you want different sort of creative outlets, or are you doing it because you're trying to stay afloat?
It's not as calculated as that. With a lot of this stuff, I do the work I want to do, and opportunities arise and I take them. You can't end up doing this sort of political commentary thing I do by design. You can't email news outlets and say, oh, you should have me on, because they'll just ignore you. If I'm invited on, I go, and if I'm not, I'm not gonna, that's it, you know. I've been asked this before, like, why do I do musicals and political commentary and stand-up, and, you know, why have I got fingers in all these pies, I suppose. And it isn't it's just that I do what I want to do when I feel like doing it, and they're not always the same thing. And I suppose I also get bored of doing the same thing all the time. So I like to move on. I like to change things up. And you know, I don't envisage doing Titania much more than another year or so. I think things have to move on to keep me interested.
And when you were writing for Jonathan Pye, so we all know as performers, we can workshop jokes on stage and, you know, try them out at work in progress nights or you know, Comedy Unleashed, wherever. For videos, it strikes me as a very different beast because you have to, you put it up and you can't really edit it out or change it. How do you workshop stuff for a video?
But it doesn't matter so much whether it all works because it's not, you don't have an audience response there. It's not dependent on an audience response.
Interesting.
So like with the reason why stand-ups have to refine their work so much is because of the nature of the audience. If you've got if you've got like a 3-minute set piece and you're only getting one laugh there, you're going to have to change it. You're going to have to add detail. You're going to have to mess around. If you do a 3-minute video online, you don't need any laugh out loud moments, actually. Particularly with a character like Jonathan Pye, where if people like the view that's being expressed, they'll share it anyway. But that's the difference. When it came to writing the live shows for the character, you had to have pretty regular, you had a high gag rate. You had a high laugh moment. You needed that because you hear the response. You don't do that with a video.
Yeah, I get that, but I suppose you have another form of feedback in the comments and the upvotes and things like that. I mean, did you ever read the comments?
Oh yeah, but they're insane, aren't they? If you read through,
I stick off, so I don't really touch you. I watch it, but I don't ever put stuff on YouTube because literally just it's become the, unless you were historically a YouTuber,
yeah,
and you've got your own little base that kind of outweigh the idiots. Every time I put something up, you know, it would be just ridiculous vitriol for no reason.
Well, it's either vitriol or it's people do this weird thing where they just quote their favorite line.
Yeah.
Back at under, which is not, I don't get it. I don't get why anyone would, I would never, it would take a lot for me to comment under an article anyway. But that strikes me as really odd. And people say the weirdest things under those. You're best not to read below the line, to be honest.
Right? Yeah, totally.
I'm going to say that I'm a bit of a hypocrite because people will send me messages on Twitter and they're obviously mad and idiotic, but I'll get trapped into talking to them. I like to give people the benefit of the doubt. And then after a couple of tweets, I realise, oh, this person's insane. And then you just walk away from it at that point. But,
completely.
You know, but yeah, you do get that feedback. That feedback's not really, that's not useful feedback. Not like an audience response is useful feedback, you know, not like the sound of a, you know, when you land a joke and it never fails to get everyone laughing, you think that's a great, I know that works. And it works with different types of audiences and that kind of thing. That's really gratifying, isn't it? But you don't need that with a video.
No, completely. So these are the last quick fire questions.
Okay.
They're quick for me, but you take as long as you like. Who was the first person to believe in you?
As in, to believe it, that I had any kind of ability.
Yeah.
I suppose going back to, don't know, going back to school, I suppose. Earliest person, teacher, would have been either one of my early teachers. Maybe Mrs. Appleby, maybe Mrs. Mackay. Yeah, I mean, she spoke to my mother about something I'd written. I was 5, I think. And I'd written a story, and she told my mother that this was exceptionally good and that I had some kind of talent here and it you know that I should, and she sort of suggested things that I should read and things like that, so maybe it's her.
Okay.
That would make sense. Yeah.
What's one unpopular opinion you have about the comedy industry?
That the comedy industry establishment is essentially woke, which I think we all know is true, but it's definitely an unpopular opinion to express.
Right. A lot of comedians would call themselves comedians, but they make more money from something else. Like they might have a day job, or they might be doing something else. How would you define yourself, and how would your income define you?
I'm a writer and comedian. I don't do anything else.
Okay.
So, I mean, I used to be a teacher. I mean, when I started, I was working all through the day as a teacher and gigging at night. It's very exhausting.
Yes.
But I haven't done that for many years. So that's how I sustain my income, is writing and comedy.
Okay. What is the biggest mistake you've ever made, and how did you overcome it? It doesn't have to be a comedy mistake; it can be any mistake.
Biggest mistake I've ever made. That's a really, really difficult question. I mean, arguably, I suppose it's—is it a mistake? I don't know, but I suppose the biggest mistake would be that I was such a lazy boy at school. I did no work at all. I was very... I just relied on intelligence to get through. And actually, as a result, I underachieved massively. And I also feel like if I had just done a bit of reading, a bit of working, I think I would have had a much more solid grounding. Whether that's a mistake or not, you know, I feel like I was, to a degree, failed by the education system insofar as I wasn't disciplined particularly well. And I do believe that autonomy in adulthood depends on effective socialization as a child. But I suppose I should take responsibility for myself as well. So a bit of both. Yeah, I think I was lazy. I think I felt like I was... When I was in my 20s, I felt like I was catching up on my education. I felt like I was educating myself. I read an awful lot. I still do. I feel like I was making up for lost time. And I think that lack of grounding was a real wasted opportunity.
Mm. Who do you think is the most underrated person in the comedy industry?
I used to say Victoria Wood. Because although she was massively popular and successful, comedians rarely admitted to liking her for a long time, and then she died and they all said they loved her. But who would I say now? Now I would say probably David Mills, who I think is one of the best stand-ups in the country, and for some reason is not a household name. I don't get that. I don't understand that. I mean, if you watch him do a stand-up set, it is mind-blowingly good. The writing, the style, he's unlike anyone else. You won't see anyone else like him, and yet he's not as well known, anywhere near as well known as he should be. So I would go with him, I think.
Okay. He might just not want to be famous.
Maybe not, but more people should know of his work.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm just, yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think is the biggest problem in the comedy industry, and how would you solve it?
The wokeness. The idea that comedy is there to educate rather than to entertain. That sort of arrogance about the industry. I think that's the thing that needs to change the most. The idea that the belief that most comedians have, or seem to have, that the public are really these malleable things, and that they can't, that they need to joke in a certain way. They can't, in other words, they don't trust their audience. They don't trust their audience to get nuance, to get ambiguity, to get irony, all of that sort of stuff, I think is really sad. And it comes out of a very snobbish worldview. And it's largely because the industry is so middle class, I guess. Well, that is probably the origin of it. But yeah, that's the thing. I feel like if we could get over that, the art, it cripples the art form, basically, when performers feel that they have to work within very strict parameters in order to be successful. It means that no one takes risks anymore, or very few people do. And the people that do are punished for it. I mean, we know this, don't we? I mean, old tweets get pulled up. This week, Sarah Silverman admitted that she lost a major Hollywood contract because she performed an anti-racist sketch 8 years ago, which has nonetheless been taken completely literally by idiots. You know, and the idiots who take it literally, no, aren't the audiences, right? The audiences get that it was an anti-racist joke. She wasn't blacking up in order to express contempt for black people. And you would have to be genuinely amoeba level stupidity to think that. But unfortunately, in the woke cult, the woke movement, it is a basic amoeba level of stupidity. Mm. And they take it literally. And that's so that if we can get over that, then we can have another golden age of comedy, maybe.
Mm. When was your first artistic scar or stumbling block, and how did you get through it?
I've had so many. You know,
pick your favorite.
Blimey. Yeah. First.
Well, the first one that really stands out that pivoted you or changed something about your character or writing.
I mean, I've kept all of my rejection letters from when I was like trying to write plays and get plays on and all this sort of thing and sending stuff away, and I was constantly getting knocked back. I think you know, if you don't have those contacts, if you don't have that, you know, you just have to persist. Basically, I can't think of there's any one in particular. There are so many, but it's almost like a gradual death by paper cut situation. You can allow it to get on top of you, or you can keep persisting. Once you learn that critics, for instance, are responding to a fashion, they are one of the best ways that you can determine the fashion of any particular era is to look at its criticism, because what they are generally doing is just reflecting the fashion of the time, which means that they're often wrong, which means that it doesn't really matter what they say. Once you get past that, once you realize that, you become a bit more bulletproof. So getting knocked back, getting, you know, I've had shows which have been hugely well received and shows that have been condemned, you know. Neither matters. What matters is you're making the art that you believe in. But yeah, those sort of knockbacks, you learn to deal with it. I'm pretty immune to it now, actually, I think. And because I'm so used to being attacked online by people who think I'm a Nazi, I've developed this kind of, I mean, I am a sensitive person, you know, I'm not going to pretend I'm not, but I'm sort of jaded with it. I'm bored with it. It just doesn't mean much to me. I didn't really answer the question.
That's okay. So last two, what's the best bit of advice you've ever been given?
The best advice I've ever been given was from I had two supervisors when I was doing my doctorate at Oxford. One was Catherine Duncan Jones, the other was Robin Robbins. Both brilliant scholars. Robin said to me, whatever you do, don't go into academia. He said, you'll end up an old man running around the quad screaming, why have I wasted my life? That was the best advice I got. I mean, I was a part-time lecturer and I was spending most of my time in the Duke Humphreys Library, which is this ancient library in the Bodleian in Oxford, which is where they filmed the Harry Potter library. That's how old it looked. You know, the books are chained to the wall. They actually are. They didn't CGI that in. That is what it's like. And it's a dark, dismal place. And you spend your days in there trying to decipher early modern handwriting, because I learned how to read Renaissance handwriting. And you'd spend half an hour deciphering something out of some journal. And it would just someone talking about their recipe for flan or something. You know, something stupid like that. So it can be quite disheartening. And I think academia has become so politically conformist, and there are such problems within universities, and also I wasn't enjoying it, so I got out of it. I'd sort of decided that that's what I had to do because I was on that track and I'd been funded so much by research bodies and stuff that I thought I had to do this, and then I realized, no, actually I can move to London, live with an elderly friend of mine, be poor and do stupid stand-up shows.
Fair. Last question. If you could go back to any point in your career and give your past self one bit of advice, what would it be?
It would be never change your material on the basis of what other people think, ever. And never apologise for what you do. That's what I would do. I think early on I was doing that awful thing of trying to anticipate what would be successful. Once I got over that, then I started having a modicum of success. That would be the best thing I could suggest to anyone. It just won't come. The inauthenticity of someone trying to chase the zeitgeist is off-putting, I think, and people know it's happening and people sense it. So I think just honesty with yourself and is the best thing for the creative process.
Cool. Well, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
That was Andrew. I loved hearing about his thoughts on social media as a tool to sell tickets, books, merch, as well as the value of creating a character who can say things that you can't, and creating different personas that allow you to explore comedy in different areas that you maybe were not initially able to because you can't say certain things on stage, just like he did with Titania. I loved hearing his thought process behind all the characters as well as the creation of them. I really enjoyed it and I hope you got lots out of it as well. I also think if you can, you should look up Comedy Unleashed and maybe go and check out a show. Don't let The Guardian or any other newspaper tell you what it's like. I've done it. I can tell you now, I had a brilliant time and it was lovely. It was a really diverse crowd, which is, I wouldn't say a rarity in London, but I would say that everyone sort of has their tribe. Whereas with this one, it felt like there were so many different opinions in the room, which was awesome to have. So I knew when something landed, it landed with most people that were in different groups, and it was because it was funny, not because I was preaching to my own choir, which is so hard to not do in this day and age. As I mentioned earlier, there's a link to my book in the show notes, How to Make a Living by Working for Free. You can get a copy for £5 digitally. It is a how-to guide on how to create your online audience and then monetize it by asking them, would they like for you to continue to create things? If so, give them some money. Speaking of which, if you would like to become a patron of the podcast from just $1, you can do that right now. There's a link in the show notes. You can also do a one-off donation on paypal.com. Again, there's a link in the show notes. Other episodes you might be interested in include the one with Jonathan Pye, who Andrew co-wrote with for, I think it was three, four years, he used to write the character online. If you don't know Jonathan Pye or Titania, there are links in the show notes. You can check that out as well. You should also check out the podcast with Richard Herring about how he built his online audience to increase his offline audience and how he has now turned that into an entirely different model for someone as established as him. He now has such a direct relationship with his audience and gets so much more than he ever could have imagined by going direct to them and being funny and asking them to support him. It's such an exciting episode. I highly recommend you go back and listen to it. The Ask the Industry podcast is a Fruit That Got in Gravity's Way production for the internet. All elements were created by me, comedian Simon Kane. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for subscribing. And thank you very much for rating and donating if you do. I'll see you all in about 14 days' time. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.